From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Crypto Creatures with Nick Redfern, a classic coast-to-coast program. Well, California officials are now offering $150,000 to find arson suspects in those deadly wildfires. The raised bounty in an effort to find the suspects behind the string of deadly wildfires still burning out of control that are responsible for a number of deaths, more than 1,500 destroyed homes, and nearly 500,000 scorched acres. The $150,000 reward came as President Bush toured some of the hardest hit areas in San Diego and promised federal aid for thousands of victims. I want to take just a few moments, first of all, to tell you Evelyn Paglini will be Art's guest Friday night, first hour. Art's going to do the program for me. And some time ago, Evelyn on Art's program talked about these kinds of fires. It was an uncanny prediction, and Art will be talking with Evelyn about that on the first hour. So make sure you're listening to that program. Also, I want to say thank you to the incredible work that the firefighters and volunteers throughout Southern California have done and provided to so many people in trying to fight this. I mean, they have been going around the clock. Those of us, I'm in St. Louis now, I'm not back in L.A., do not really appreciate the scope of what they're doing until you see it firsthand. And I've got a lot of friends who have witnessed what they've done firsthand. And many, many thanks on behalf of everybody in this country to what you're doing out there, as well as those at two of our major affiliates. One, of course, KFI in Los Angeles, the other, KOGO Cogo in San Diego, where the staffs of those stations have been working around the clock as well to provide their listeners the up-to-date minute information and safety information. And just proud to be associated with all of you. And some other news, some 1 million foam baby seats sold by Target, Walmart stores, and other large retailers are being recalled because of reports of young children falling out of seats, according to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. The agency said it received 28 reports of young children falling out of the seats. Three suffered skull fractures. Please be careful. They were made by a company called Bumbo International of South Africa, sold for about $40 from August 2003 through October of 2007. Turkey says it's running out of patience and will not tolerate Kurdish rebels' use of Iraqi soil to launch terrorist attacks against them. 64 suspected rebels have been killed by Turkish troops already. If you're stressed out and can't sleep, a study says 48% of Americans say they're more stressed now than they were 5 years ago. And the same percent regularly reports lying awake at night because of stress. Maybe that's why coast-to-coast ratings are so high. Everybody's awake now. So what does it all mean? Well, primarily two things, money and work. Don't let those things stress you out. The family of a man whose dying wish was to be buried with his mobile phone, they're going to have to dig him up because they forgot to put that SIM card in the phone. Apparently, the man's grandson was playing with his phone before they dropped it in the casket. The kid took the SIM card out. Family said, no, we got to give dad a complete phone. An Alabama etiquette expert who was pranked in the hit Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Ketsiskan, is suing the bad-mannered movie makers. Kathy Martin wants unspecified monetary damages. She was featured in the movie by the make-believe journalist Borat, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, where he was showing her some strange photographs that she didn't like. Couple emails throughout the night about Uri Geller starting clocks. This is from our friend, the detective in Chicago, says, I pulled out an old watch that I used to love wearing because of the easy-to-read large face and numbers on it, George. It stopped working a few years ago. Well, guess what? It started ticking again. I would have lost the farm. But then again, I don't have a farm, so it wouldn't have been that bad. That's our friend at the Chicago Police Department, and we had many, many more. In a moment, two major stories with our special guest, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Linda's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, of course, our investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, earthfiles.com. She goes all over the place to get to the stories and the truth. She's got two incredible stories for us tonight. The first one here is about a young Sasquatch. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I tell you, when I heard about this, about 3 weeks ago, for the first time from Matthew Moneymaker at BFRO,
yeah,
it was, we got to stay quiet about this for a couple of weeks, and the hunters who were involved with this game trail camera that I'm going to talk to you about were trying to find out themselves what is this. And finally, when I did talk with Matthew, he was becoming convinced this might be a juvenile Sasquatch. And when you look back over just even a century, my God, big, hairy, primate-looking Sasquatch or Bigfoot have been reported in North America and other parts of the world
sure.
for a very long time. And some eyewitnesses have described seeing male and female Sasquatch with smaller animals that they say are probably Sasquatch juveniles. And even though no one has gotten any clear photographs, movie film, or videotapes of young ones, eyewitnesses say large Sasquatch have been known to aggressively protect their territory and presumably a family in that territory. Campers have described having rocks thrown at them and been physically charged by big, growling, long-haired ape creatures apparently trying to get humans out of their perceived territory. Well, in mid-September 2007, about a month ago, deer hunter R. Jacobs was not thinking about Sasquatch Bigfoot when he placed a deer mineral lick and deer attracting scents where he set up his Bushnell game trail camera in northwestern Pennsylvania. All he wanted to know was how many deer, especially big bucks, were using the trail so that he could plan his deer hunt. Well, the camera automatically senses light and can take color photos in the daytime and switch to infrared at night with or without flash. And the camera was set to go off with motion in front of that lens. On three frames dated September 16th, 2007, beginning at 4 minutes and 23 seconds after 8 p.m. local time, there are two black bear cubs at the block of mineral lick, and I arranged for Lex to show a couple of the photos at
yep.
the Post website. I have the photos in my report tonight at earthfiles.com, and BFRO, their website, has a lot of photos and their story with R. Jacobs. So we're finally getting these images out so all of you listening can see very, very provocative possibility that this is a juvenile Sasquatch Bigfoot. Well, okay, so we have got little black bears in this one frame. And then you move forward in time about a half hour. It was 27 minutes and 42 seconds later. The mineral lick is knocked over. That's the black square in the foreground of that second photo. And there is an animal that looks more like a primate than a bear, but the head is not visible. And then, 36 seconds after that, a third image shows the primate-looking animal in a posture that at first is very confusing. But to people knowledgeable about primate behavior, the odd posture could be an animal, like a primate, that is smelling something on the ground while its buttocks is up in the air. And the deer hunter, R. Jacobs, was so puzzled about what his game trail camera had photographed that he started showing these images to his family and friends. And his teenage daughter suggested it might be a juvenile Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And she went to the internet, searched, came to the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, also known as BFRO. Well, BFRO was formed in 1995 by a group of field investigators who wanted to pool resources for expeditions to look for Sasquatch. The group's director is Matthew Moneymaker, who has been on 40 Sasquatch expeditions and has been within 100 feet of the big hairy primates at least a dozen times. Once in the moonlight at 2 a.m., Matthew was charged, or as he said, maybe you would use the word instead of charged, approached by an 8-foot-tall hairy creature that was growling only 15 feet away. Matthew told me, quote, "I didn't feel he wanted to kill me. He just wanted us to move out of his territory," unquote. By Friday, October 19th, with the deer hunter's permission, Matthew placed the three images on the BFRO website for feedback. That night, I interviewed him and began by asking Matthew what his own personal first reaction was to the infrared images.
There it is.
Oh, I immediately knew that it was a young Squatch, especially to see the bear cubs and using that as a gauge of the size and knowing that this is a fairly small figure, and especially the quadrupedal stance. Like in the first image, people think, oh, it's leaning over. I've told them, I said, no, that's the way they walk. That's the thing walking along as it normally does, what you see in the first image. And I've talked to a few witnesses who've seen them run quadrupedally, and then they'll get up on two legs.
The photo one, it is leaning and stretching out, and you do not see a clear picture of the head. And then in the next photograph, which at first is confusing, but then if you look at the top of the creature as being its buttocks going straight up in the air, and that it has its head down, that makes some sense out of that second photo. And I think you've talked with somebody about this being a chimpanzee type of behavior.
Yes, apes will very often smell the ground, and they will get in that kind of a posture. They'll outstretch their arms, and they'll put their face right into the ground like that.
Did the hunters go back to that site and look for any of the larger 14 to 17 to 18 inch prints that have become associated with Sasquatch?
I believe they did. They mentioned that. They even said they were surprised that they didn't find any larger tracks there. But you're only going to get clear tracks if you have exposed soil. And even then, it's got to be exposed either wet soil like mud or very loose soil like sand. So you just don't get very clear, obvious tracks in most situations, because usually in a forest, the ground is not exposed. It has pine needles and leaves and sticks, and then usually got a good layer of that if it's a dense forest. They didn't find any, but of course, they're looking for them now.
Well, that's good. Is it fair to say that you and BFRO are convinced that this is the clearest photograph of a young Sasquatch that anybody has been able to record?
I believe it is. As far as ones that have been circulated, yeah, these are far and away the most compelling.
The camera was damaged twice, or the two cameras were damaged there at that trail?
Yes. I had asked them, you know, after I saw the photos, I said, are the cameras still up there? And the brother said they had to take them down because they got broken and they had to get them fixed. And he goes, the first one, something had smashed the lens, and they sent it back to Bushnell and they got it repaired. And then they put out another camera, the same type, and it got smashed even more. Both brothers, they didn't know what this figure was, this small figure. They didn't know what we knew about the history, at least among Bigfoot researchers, of placing cameras out where Sasquatches are seen and then coming back and finding them smashed.
Right. And isn't it true that it is the flashes on cameras that seems to provoke the attention of the Sasquatch Bigfoot?
It might be the flash, and it may be simply the appearance of the camera, a man-made object, on the side of a tree. It could very well be that it's the flash. And I'll tell you, when we've set up game cameras, flash cameras, when you walk in front of a flash game camera and it goes off at night, it will blind you temporarily. I mean, you won't be able to see anything for a little while because it's such a bright flash. I'll tell you, if I was walking through the woods and then one flashed at me, I'd be a little angry myself, and I might want to do something to that camera. And in some cases where, you know, they put them on a tree and found the tree pushed over so it would fall onto the camera. People that we've talked to who've tried to use trail cameras to get photos of these things have described that numerous times. I'll tell you, the researchers who put those cameras out there thought it was the thing that they were trying to photograph had actually damaged the camera.
And you mean Sasquatch?
Yes. I always remember one particular witness who I got to know very well, and he had helped take me to the place where I had the closest encounter I ever had to one, where I had one walk up with about 15 feet away from me. It was growling at me. Not far from there, he had been pursued by a young one, and it ran, and they would see them at night in the dark, and they described them almost as panther-like, running very agilely on all fours and being able to climb and go over fences, climb up a fence and then down the other side of the fence using, you know, its arms and legs as it was climbing up a fence, being able to climb up in a tree and sit up on its haunches. And there is other, from other parts of the country, there were sketches of young ones, again, showing them in that kind of quadrupedal stance. So this is very consistent with what we folks in the BFRO had suspected a young one would look like. I've been close to these things on several occasions. The behavior, you know, the way they'll come up and they'll growl and they'll follow you, and sometimes they'll throw things. And there was one occasion, it would have taken a few steps to be right on top of me.
Well, when was that? What date, where, and how big was this Sasquatch?
That was about 7.5 feet tall, and it was July 1994 in Portage County, Ohio, on the Berlin Wildlife Refuge in Ohio. We were staking out this road coming out of the wildlife refuge leading into a farming area where a lot of the farmers in the area had reported seeing them and hearing them and finding their tracks. We were staking that out, expecting them to come out along this road, and they did. But we think it was because the light coming out of our night vision devices of the guy I was with, we think they spotted us first, and they kind of went into, instead of walking down the road in front of us, they circled around and they bluff charged at him, and then the larger one came up around and back of me and came to the edge of the tree line, and I was kind of hunkered down behind a little berm, and it came out and growled at me and let me know that it knew I was there and that I shouldn't be there. I mean, that was certainly the sense that I got about it. And I got up and was talking in its direction, like you would if you had a dog come in your direction and growl at you, how you would kind of instinctively say, okay, all right. That's what I was doing toward this thing as I was picking up all my stuff and walking away. And I wasn't really scared as much. I was happy because, well, I knew the thing, if it stopped and growled in the way, the kind of raspy way it was growling, I knew that's all it was going to do. And the fact that it wouldn't come out very far, it was staying right at the tree line so it could just take a step back and it would disappear back into the brush. It was partial moonlight and it was about 2:30 a.m. So I could see the shape of the thing. I could see that it was hairy and it was about 7 to 8 feet tall, and that it was clearly not a person. The proportions were just way off the scale. The guy who was with me, who they had bluff charged, he was about close to 100 feet away. He did shine a light on it, and he did a detailed drawing of it. And we have a page on the website about eyewitness sketches from Ohio, and there's one of the sketches was from what he saw that night. It's on our website.
Ohio is right on the border with western Pennsylvania.
It is indeed. And there's a lot of sightings in especially eastern Ohio and in western Pennsylvania. And we believe the reason is because there's a large deer population.
And for you, you are absolutely convinced that Sasquatch exists and you've had your own firsthand experiences. Why do you think that this creature remains mythological for most of the population? Why has one not been captured in the last 100 or 200 years?
That's if you were in the thick of it like we are, and you'd say, well, where would they go? Where would they hide? It's funny because when you go to the sorts of remote places that we go, you know that humans in these vast areas only will walk along, say, the roads or the trails, and will only be like upon, 2% of that land. And it's dangerous to walk off of a trail or a road in a really thick, rugged, area. And then try to capture them. That would assume that, everyone is trying to capture them, whereas no one is trying to capture them. And these things operate at night.
Matthew Moneymaker hopes that more hunters will set out game trail cameras with infrared at night, so hopefully more images like R. Jacobs could emerge. And I talked this week with Jeff Meldrum. He's a PhD professor of human anatomy at Idaho State University, has perhaps the largest collection, about 200 plaster casts of alleged Bigfoot Sasquatch footprints. His book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, is wonderful. And I asked him to look at the photographs, and what was his reaction? And his first word was, "This is intriguing." And he said at first he did not think the limb proportions in the photograph could be a bear because they are so long, but he cautioned that the infrared images might be a black bear following the two cubs, but wants to do more research. And as he pointed out, we don't know anything about the birth, the growth, and the evolution of these often reported large creatures, and that the proportions of a young one is something that is still unknown, and that what R. Jacobs captured on his infrared camera trying to prepare for a deer hunt might be the very first two images of a juvenile Sasquatch.
What a great story, Linda. And we'll be back with more Red Rain Cells of India. Well, not for too much longer. Soon it'll be the City of Angels again. And then we're into our holiday schedule. We'll be on and off. By the way, just so you know, a little footnote, we will have live programs for you on Thanksgiving night and that Friday, right after Thanksgiving. And I'll also be here live on Christmas Eve and on Christmas night. So make a note about that. And Art should be here on New Year's Eve for his annual prediction show. I may be on vacation that week. I'm not sure yet. And don't forget also, Art will be on this Friday for me and also on Wednesday on Halloween of next week for Ghost to Ghost. Back with Linda Moulton Howe in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, what'd you think of that Bigfoot story? A little Sasquatch.
Well, I'm absolutely fascinated by this because it was only about 4 or 5 years ago that I did a field investigation. It was a Discovery Channel distribution, and it was a Hong Kong production company. And we were on the border of Laos and Vietnam up in absolute, talk about getting to remote places on the earth. And our whole reason for being there was that the locals up near the DMZ were reporting these very tall, hairy creatures. And some people had said that they had found these long, reddish-brown hairs on the trees. And when the crew and I were there during the production, we stayed in a place that was surrounded by mountains, and we had been told by the villagers which directions that they heard sometimes these noises. And I had brought an audio tape from the 1970s, this eerie high pitch that I've played on Coast to Coast many times.
Right.
And we played that sound for the locals, and they would nod their head. Well, the one night that we were there overnight inside of our thick mosquito netting, I came right up, right out of sleep, sitting straight up, hearing that sound. And the thing about it was, all of our equipment was in another room. And I sat there inside of that thick mosquito netting thinking, God, if I get up and I try to record it, I'll miss hearing this. And it went on for about a minute, and it stopped. And when it stopped, I got up and let the crew know, and we went out and we waited with equipment. We never heard it again, but it was identical to the sound on the tape from the 70s of tall Sasquatch in Snohomish, Washington.
I love it. Now, this next story you've got, Linda, is absolutely fascinating.
It is.
The possibility of discovering some other kind of life form. Go ahead.
Yeah, the stories in some ways are very similar. We've got something roaming around the world. It seems very large and hairy, and nobody can nail what it is. And now, under a microscope, we have cells that replicate, and so far, nobody has been able to find any DNA. And this started publicly for the first time about a year and a half ago, when the April 4th, 2006 Journal of Astrophysics and Space Science had a report and was titled, quote, "The Red Rain Phenomenon of Kerala and Its Possible Extraterrestrial Origin," unquote. And Kerala is a state at the very southern, it's kind of southwestern tip of India on the Malabar coast. Well, what is behind this? You have to go back 6 years ago to the July-September time period in 2001, and there were a series over those 3 months of red-colored rain that fell only on sections of this state of Kerala. And people said, that they heard a loud boom associated with the first red rain, and people had white T-shirts that got stained red, and residents started asking everybody, it got to the media, what's happening? And the news of the red rain reached Dr. Godfrey Lewis, who was a professor of pure and applied physics at Mahatma Gandhi University then. And he went out and collected many test tubes full of this red-colored rainwater, and he put some of this odd liquid under a microscope. And I talked to him directly after he had been looking at it, and he said that he, as he was looking, and the thing that struck him first was this beautiful rust color of what seemed to be living cells. He couldn't believe it. He said the cell diameters averaged 10 microns, which is just a tiny bit bigger than, say, a human blood cell, which is about 7 microns. Well, he began experimenting. Here he's got these cells under a microscope. Well, what do they do? So he started working with temperature. The cells stayed viable. He knew that that meant there was something extraordinary about them. They weren't decaying. And he found this extraordinary thing that if he raised the temperature up to 300 degrees Celsius, which is 572 degrees Fahrenheit, and then he increased the pressure on the water, that they would begin to replicate. And the replication is defined so far by people who have watched this under a microscope, that these little buds that are not red are white, are inside of the red cells, and these buds keep proliferating, and then they come out of the red cells, turn red, and it is a what he calls a mother-daughter budding system. Well, that's what provokes some scientists to say, well, this must just be yeast, because yeast replicate by budding. Okay, so then they said, well, then we've got to find the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Cardiff University 1 year ago in the Center for Astrobiology with Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe, that's exactly what they were trying to do. And I was in the lab, and I was with the lab assistant who was trying to penetrate the cell walls of these red rain cells. And I was right there with him, and he said, these are the thickest walls, the stiffest walls I have ever dealt with on cells. And his name is Nori, and Nori told me that he was not at all feeling good about his work. He did not think that he was penetrating into the cell itself and getting the material that they would normally get in cells. And Professor Wickramasinghe told me that he, too, questioned whether or not they were even able to get material, but no one had been able today, up to this date, has been able to confirm DNA. Now, there were tests at Cornell University in which they were able to confirm that the elemental, this is just the elemental composition of the red rain, is so far, it's largely standard oxygen, carbon with some hydrogen, silicon, and a little bit of aluminum and some trace minerals, but no phosphorus was confirmed, which would have to be present if Earth DNA are in those cells. And so we now stand at a point where when I talk with Dr. Lewis, who is now transferred from Mahatma Gandhi to Cochin University of Science and Technology as a full professor in physics, and I talk with him just very recently and ask him about his ongoing red rain cell research, and he says that he is planning to publish within the next 3 to 4 months. And I learned to my surprise, George, that there have now been 3 episodes of red rains, all with cells that replicate at the 300 degrees Celsius, but without any known DNA. And on Earth, we don't know of replication without DNA. Now, in the following interview excerpt, my questions are asked more slowly than normal in order for Dr. Lewis to understand my American English. But I think it's important for our Coast audience to hear from the physicist who is convinced that these red rain cells are not from Earth.
This organism is operating very comfortably, such a high temperature, that is so strange. These cells can be grown at very high temperature of 300 degrees. There is no organism on Earth which can grow and multiply at this temperature, actually.
So you have cells that so far no one has been able to confirm any DNA in them. And yet when you heat up these cells, they split and reproduce.
Exactly what it is doing. This is what we find. They were not able to amplify DNA. So nobody has detected DNA in this.
How would they replicate and keep reproducing and splitting without DNA?
Yeah, that is a whole interesting question. This year, we have collected the rainwater. Exactly the same cells have fallen, red rain also. There was an incident of red rain, and we got the sample. It was the same cells.
What month was that?
That was in August.
Of 2007?
2007.
So only 2 months ago?
Yes.
When you take the August 2007 red rain water and compare it to the 2001 red rain water, how do they compare?
They are the same kind of cells have fallen at both these cases. Nobody has explained from where it can come. So there is a mystery of what it is.
Dr. Lewis, why do you think that it has been 6 years since the first red rain in Kerala, India, and the red rain has been studied by your laboratory, by Professor Wickramasinghe's laboratory before he retired at Cardiff University? And why is it that as we speak in mid-October of 2007, that no one has identified what the cells are made out of?
This is because there is a reluctance among many to accept results like this because it sounds like fiction. So even the case of announcing the absence of DNA, there is difficulty for a scientist to announce that there is no DNA in a cell because it is so outrageous to say that. It is deviates far from the what we know about life. So it is a drastic difference what we find. So there is always a hesitation for any scientist to do this. So it takes time.
And what about that red color? I thought that Cardiff University was going to try to do some sort of energy dispersive spectroscopy to see if they could identify that red substance.
The red rains, the chemical composition has not been identified. It is a difficult task. We have to find methods to extract chemicals from this and separate chemicals because, as I've said, told you, the molecular composition is totally unknown. So the conventional techniques may not work. For example, when we try to extract the DNA, there is no DNA coming out. The particular pigment, we don't know that. We have to identify it.
So even though you've got a carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and some trace elements broken down, none of those would explain the red color?
We are not able to identify that pigment out of it.
Do the cells in the vials of water that you have keep reproducing and splitting?
They don't do that in the water because it requires heat multiplying it. Not when you keep them in ordinary temperature and water, they are stable.
Does that imply to you as a scientist that whatever the origin of the red rain water is, it is coming from some sort of a surface that must be hot if this is in fact a form of life that replicates only in the presence of heat?
May not be the surface. It can be the interior of a comet because the comet, even though it's a very cold object, it can be warm, good core. So far, nobody has discovered any life form without DNA.
Now, about this comet issue, both Professor Lewis and Professor Wickramasinghe hypothesize that the red rain cells might be coming from orbiting cometary debris. But why cometary debris would repeatedly fall in 2001, 2006, and 2007 in the state of Kerala at the southernmost tip of India has not been explained. When I asked Professor Wickramasinghe about this, he said that he thinks probably that other places on the Earth have been receiving these red rain cells and maybe not noticed. And he pointed out this about the planet. If you think of a belt of latitude that goes around the Earth, where Kerala is at the southwestern tip of India. To the west, you have the Indian Ocean, or to the east, you have the Indian Ocean all the way to the Sahara. And going west, you have mountains. So if this red rain fell over a huge strip of the Earth's surface, going all the way, maybe halfway around the world, Kerala might be the only place in that particular latitude, which is about 10 degrees north of the equator, where there is a population that could detect it raining onto their white T-shirts and turning red. Well, why that particular latitude? They both scientists say that is a mystery, and that maybe it has something to do with the intersection of a cometary stream of particles that came passing through the Earth in 2001 and keep orbiting. But why is this rain only falling in the August, July, August, September time? Well, you could say that's when they have the monsoons. That's when rain is the most typical. But there are as many questions and mysteries beyond the cells, George, as the cells that they are. And if Dr. Godfrey Lewis can publish what he wants to publish, which is the work that they've done in the lab on the pressure and the temperature being so high, and being able to show that the cells continue to replicate, and if they continue to be unable to prove that there's DNA and no phosphorus in these cells. We've been waiting for that headline now for quite a while, that there are cells that do not appear to be from Earth. And it is so slow coming, as both of these scientists have said to me, because when you start talking about cells that have come down in Earth rain that replicate at 572 degrees Fahrenheit, that's almost 600 degrees Fahrenheit, and have no DNA, nobody wants to put their name on that. Isn't that, it's a very ironic, strange thing.
It really is.
We need extraordinary proof and evidence, and people have been trying. But the other scientists will say it has to be yeast because of the budding. Well, yeast has DNA, and if you put yeast in water under a pressure at 300 degrees Celsius, it's not going to survive. So whatever this is, it is breaking the rules in the laboratory of what we know about Earth life. And Dr. Lewis told me that because I asked him, I said, do you feel strongly that these red rain cells are perhaps from outer space? And this was a direct answer. He says, yes, the cells are not decaying when you keep that rainwater for years. It's now 6 years old. It can be cultured. All of it can be cultured. And the culturing is a definite clue that these are not earthly organisms because they culture at such high temperatures. So far, no DNA. The cells are not dying. They are in those test tubes. They've been there for 6 years, and he can still work with them in the lab. And this is a story that is not over. It will keep on going as long as they keep doing physics. And if they finally, if there is no confirmation of DNA, I don't know what more they are going to have to do because the cells are so hard to penetrate. And when you start working on cells, you get what is called contamination. And they're having a very hard time knowing how to even approach the rest of this mystery. And I'll keep reporting, George, on Coast whenever there is something new to report. And along new things, I would like you and the Coast audience to know that I'm going to have a brand new case at the conference in Las Vegas on that November 9th to 11th conference that Ryan Wood is putting together. And it is turning out to be so extraordinary. I will report it on Coast, I hope, in late November. And it will first be presented at the conference, the 9th through the 11th. But I'm telling you, the mysteries that are emerging, that whether you're talking about Sasquatch, Bigfoot, microscopic cells from mysterious rains, or what is our government covering up when it comes to the disc phenomenon? There sure is a lot that is beginning to break through the surface.
Only you can cover it, Linda. Thanks again. That's Linda Moulton Howe, earthfiles.com, with her monthly report here on Coast to Coast AM. I'll be back in a moment. Nick Redfern, Crypto Creatures on Coast to Coast AM.